Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Okay, good morning. This is Joey T. I'm in the trunk of Patrick's car. We're pulling up to the TV station where we're going to do a little interview with an evening magazine. It's Friday, and I am it.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is a grown man playing a schoolyard game, one that's been going on for a very, very long time.
I'm coiled. The plan is set. Beef's coming out. It's going to be here in a couple of minutes. I'm coiled like a rattlesnake, ready to fire out at him as soon as that trunk opens.
Get, you bastard!
Today on Sound Effect from KNKX, it's The Pursuit. We're going to hear more about this decades-long game of tag, also hunting killer whales and tracking down a homeless man who is heir to millions. It's all ahead on Sound Effect. Don't go away. So let's go back to that game of tag. A group of middle-aged men here in the Northwest have been playing this game intensely for 1 month out of the year, dating back to the Reagan administration. The version of tag these guys play involves planning, alliances, sleight of hand, and a little cross-dressing.
I'm only about 4 foot seven.
I'm sitting down with Patrick Schultheis, one of the players of this decades-long game of tag.
Okay. How about this?
And we're doing the usual pre-interview, get to know you. Hi, how are yous?
My name is Patrick Schultheis, and you can call me Patty with two D's. I grew up in Spokane with the rest of these losers, and I live in Kirkland now, and I'm a corporate lawyer.
Our news director grew up in Spokane, too. Aaron Hennessy, the Hennessy family.
Oh, the funeral homes?
Yeah, actually.
Yeah, oh, yeah, okay. That's where they had my dad. My dad's body was there for a while.
Okay.
Hey, I got tagged at my dad's funeral 2 days later. So.
What did he just say?
I got tagged at my dad's funeral. Three years ago, my dad passed away, and almost all of the guys happened to make it to his funeral. And I got tagged by Beef in the church as Beef was going up to communion at the funeral mass. So I'd say if you tag somebody at their dad's funeral, then there's really no limits.
Ten players who go by various nicknames, Beef, the Bruiser, Joey T, Ake, and Rafty, they stalk each other at work. Sporting events, restaurants, they break into each other's homes in the middle of the night to tag slumbering prey. They sneak into bathrooms while the unsuspecting victim taking a shower knows he's been found when a hairy arm pulls the curtain aside.
When I got tagged in the shower, it was pretty neat because Joe then took off all his clothes and hopped in the shower with me, and we got really clean as a result of that.
And afterwards, you shared a cigar.
Exactly. We stripped down to our boxers and have a tickle fight. That happens quite frequently.
This game started when all of these guys were growing up in Spokane back in the early 1980s, going to the same Catholic high school, Gonzaga Prep. There was a 20-minute break during the school day when students were encouraged to go to mass. This group decided to use that time to play tag in the hallways. Then one day, the game went off campus.
I was home because I had already finished with finals, and Joey T was it. So Joey T was going to drive up to my parents' house and tag me during that 20-minute period. Well, somebody tipped me off.
By the time Joey T got to the house, Patty was hunkered down inside his mother's car, doors locked, windows rolled up.
And I waited him out. He was there. He tried all the doors and so forth, and he couldn't get through. He wasn't willing to break a car window. And then that was the last we played, and so he was it for life.
Fast forward to Christmas in 1989, when everyone was starting to launch into the world after college. They were all back in Spokane, drinking beer at Jack and Dan's Tavern.
And we were teasing Joey T because he was it for life. And somebody had mercy on him and said, well, why don't we start playing again? And so the group of guys fueled by hops and barley, I expect, determined that it would be good to have the 10 of us play. We would do it in February only, though. So we would expand it from 20 minutes to an entire month. And we started up. I was a first-year lawyer right out of law school, so I wrote a contract with the rules in it. And I sent it around. I put it in envelopes and sent it around, and all 10 guys signed it and mailed it back to me.
There are three simple rules.
February only, no touchbacks, and the rule of honesty. So if I ask Chris, are you it? He's got to answer truthfully and reasonably promptly. And if he doesn't, then he cannot tag me.
Today, about half of the players live in the Seattle area and the other half live in Spokane. One's in Montana. Asking if someone is it before meeting up with them in February for lunch or a coffee, this doesn't really keep you safe. During that month, if you aren't it, you won't necessarily know who is. You always have to have in the back of your mind, I am being pursued.
A few years ago, I was it. It was in February. I don't remember what year it was. I suggested to Mikey K that he ask Chris to get together with him for coffee one morning. And Mike said, I'm not going to be there. I said, that's okay. It doesn't matter because Chris is going to ask you, are you it? And you're going to say no, because that's the truth. You're not it. In the meantime, you'll never show up. I'll show up and I'll tag him. And that worked.
Chris Ahman, who also goes by the nickname Leap, totally fell for it.
I didn't even think twice about it. You know, Mike said, hey, this is me for coffee, I'm sure. And I walk into the coffee place and there's Pat and I walk up, I'm like, what are you? And I realized I even had.
So, but then everyone would know that you would then be it.
Well, so Mike and Pat would know, but not necessarily the rest of the group. The rest of the group isn't going to know that that tag happened unless Pat or Mike go out and start telling people, which they might to protect somebody if they formed an alliance.
So the tags are not broadcast out to the group?
No.
A tag can be unloaded a dozen times onto different players before the last one sticks at the very end of the month. Given how quickly a tag can happen, seeing one in action in person is considered to be a rare experience. Most of us will never be lucky enough to witness such cunning, strategy, and speed coming together in one final touch. Over the years, some of the players started recording the tags, like this one by Joey T and Beef. Dressed as slightly hairy nuns, they waited outside a restaurant to tag their buddy Brian.
Hello, Sister Reginalda. It's nice to see you today, Sister Reginalda.
Glad to see you here.
Yes, thank you. You look so beautiful.
Actually, they look a little scary.
We're going to make him it. We're going to make him it for the day.
Right. Well, that's his penance, of course, you know, for all the sins he's committed since third grade.
The tag was a success. Afterwards, Brian, his son, and the nuns caught up. Chris says hanging out after a tag goes down, that's just what they do. All of these guys are very close and would probably stay in touch just fine without tag, but the game is sort of like a little extra glue that keeps them connected.
I watch my son. He doesn't call his friends all that often or go see. It's texting and constantly, and this way it is something that we're spending some time together. I mean, when Joe got me in the movie theater, he stayed for the movie. He went out with my wife and the friends that we were at the movie with. We went out and had some appetizers and some drinks at a bar around the corner. And so it was, you know, I spent 3 hours with Joe that night that I, without the tag game, I wouldn't have happened that night.
As the group gets older, Patty wonders what will happen when they start to die off.
It would be really interesting to see if somebody's it and he dies. Ooh. You know, do you tag, does a corpse, how does it work with that? You know, maybe the priest is the only one who can remove the tag at that point, because I'm not sure you can go to heaven while you're it.
Pretty soon, you'll be able to spend about 2 hours with these characters, fictionalized versions of them. Their story is being turned into a movie. Will Ferrell and Jack Black are attached to star in the film.
The movie's now going to be an R-rated movie.
It's not clear yet if there will be a shower scene or hairy nuns armed with rulers. One can only hope. Welcome back to Sound Effect here on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today all of our stories are about the pursuit in one way or another. Ted Griffin founded and operated Seattle's first aquarium, and he's the first person to swim publicly with an orca, Namu, in 1965. He then captured, swam with, and sold dozens of whales to other aquariums. That practice is highly controversial now, and the participants are widely viewed as villains. But some historians think this needs a little context. For a long time, orcas were seen as a dangerous nuisance to fishermen. Jason Colby is a professor of ecological history at the University of Victoria, and he's working on a book about Griffin as a man who helped radically change how we see and protect these whales. Colby says at the time, the main MO for scientists looking to study a big marine mammal was to kill it and dissect its body.
The alternative was not between whale watching and whale catching. It was between whale killing and whale catching. The thing that made him strange in the eyes of many was that he was actually willing to go out and try to figure out a way to catch them alive. And even, you know, God forbid, to swim with them.
88.5's Bellamy Palethorpe wanted to know more about who Griffin is and what motivated him. He's 80 years old now, and he told her that growing up in Tacoma on the shores of Gravelly Lake, he'd spend hours watching life underwater.
And how did that evolve into this desire to capture and ride an orca whale years later?
Well, my neighbor had a horse, and he would ride it in the lake. And I thought, gee, I wish I could do that. And then one day I saw somebody riding a dolphin. That was Greek mythology, and it was on a coin. And I thought, I can do that. And it wasn't until later that I thought a whale would be more suitable.
And this became a truly deep-held dream of yours. It was like a vision that possessed you.
Probably something that few of us ever experienced, but my whole life was focused on getting in the water with a whale and swimming with a whale and making friends with it. And the things that I did, nobody in their right mind would have done. But to me, it was just a natural consequence of what I wanted more than anything in life. I wanted to be friends with that whale.
And so you achieved this eventually by, first you set up an aquarium on the Seattle waterfront, and this was like during the era of the World's Fair, and you started collecting sea life, and you didn't quite get the whale at first. It took a while.
Well, I put a sign over the door that had a picture of a whale. But the aquarium was built in 1962 during the World Fair, and I immediately began looking for killer whales and trying to figure out how to catch them. And I thought, well, I'll just jump out of the boat, put a lasso around, and I'll have him. This went on for 4 years. I did a lot of things that were really, I dare not tell you what they were about.
What do you mean?
I mean, when people jump out of boats and get in the water with live killer whales, and the whales swim away, but they think you're going to be eaten, they think you're absolutely crazy. And I ignored them. I knew that I could make friends with that whale. That was the most important thing in my life.
And so you hired helicopters, you had seaplanes, tugs out there. How much money and effort did you put into this before you succeeded?
Well, in those days, probably $30,000, $40,000, which I didn't have, but I spent it anyway. It's the modern way, you know, for spending money. At any rate, I thought, well, I'll jump out of the helicopter and make friends with the whale by getting alongside of him. But nothing seemed to work until one day, by accident, a whale was captured in a net, which I thought was impossible.
So ultimately, it was these fishermen up near the town of Namu in British Columbia. They accidentally trapped a whale in, or a couple of whales in a net.
I'd talked to fishermen for many years about catching whales in nets, and they all said the same thing. The whales will swim right through your net, and you can't hold them. And so when I got to the town of Namu and looked at the whales sitting behind a very lightweight gill net, I thought, well, then it can't be the strength of the net that's keeping them. It has to be something else.
What was it?
It turned out to be their echolocation, their ability to see the net with sound and think that it's a barrier they cannot get through.
Hmm. And so you had scrounged together $8,000. This was in 1965, and you had to give this money in cash to these fishermen in order to get them.
Well, scrounge is a polite word. I went to the waterfront merchants and pounded on the counter until they opened their safes and gave me money. And I told them that I would be back maybe with a whale. But I raised $8,000 on Sunday morning and flew to Canada and purchased the whale that day.
How did you convince them?
Well, they knew me as a waterfront character, if you will. I used to jump in the water with seals and sea lions and swim around in Elliott Bay. Sometimes the harbor tour boat would come by and I'd wave at him, and the people would say, I have to rescue this skin diver. And of course, I had an octopus draped over my back, and they'd pull me out and the octopus would come with me. That's the way it was. They all knew me.
So you got the $8,000 together, went there, and now you have this whale.
I then had to start how I'm going to get this whale out of the rock pock where he is stuck behind nets 400 miles back to Seattle. So we got back to Seattle after 19 days, and that was the beginning of the time I spent in the water with Namu. And it's kind of tricky. You think, if I do this, will a whale do something? Well, a whale seemed to enjoy my company. In fact, it got to the point where he wouldn't let me go. He wanted me to stick around all the time.
You became famous as the first man to ever swim with a killer whale in a public exhibition. It's a practice that became very popular. What was it like for you that first time?
Well, I want to say it was scary, but it wasn't. It was just, I was being cautious and careful, but I knew I could do it. I had so much drive and energy to get in the water and be with that whale and make friends with that whale. That's all I wanted in the world.
You did develop what you describe in your book, Namu, Quest for the Killer Whale, as a really deep connection, a deep relationship with this whale. How would you describe that?
I guess I have to say that in my way, I was in love with a whale. I was in love with a whale before, and I was in love with a whale when I actually got next to him. And when I realized that he knew me, he could tell me from other people, that he would come when I would call, that he would respond to my actions. If I gave him a signal, he would obey immediately. He seemed to want to please me. And at that point, the bond continued to grow.
What surprised you the most about your interaction with him?
Probably the most surprising thing was the lack of the whale's danger. You know, if you reach in the mouth and grab the tongue and the whale just backs up and won't bite down on your arm, and you leave an arm and a salmon in the whale's mouth and the whale somehow gets the salmon but doesn't bite the arm, you begin to wonder what is going on with this animal. Actually, what's going on with me?
And you would spend 12, 14 hours a day with him in the water.
Too long. I'd get out, I couldn't walk. My fingers were all rough. My skin diving suit was, I was so sore I couldn't take it off. But I had to stay in the water until I was just about drowned.
And this went on for about a year, and then Namu got sick and died.
It went on for a long time. When I moved Namu back to Seattle after making a motion picture film, Namu, the whale was in Seattle on exhibit, and I swam with him several times a day. But he did get sick, and it turned out to be the polluted water of the Puget Sound Elliott Bay. And he died from a poison called Clostridium. And as a result of that, that basically ended my relationship with that whale.
You fell into a bit of a depression afterwards, didn't you?
I never really got over the loss of the whale. And I have to be careful when I talk about it because I keep thinking it's yesterday or today or tomorrow. But I wanted to make friends with another whale, but it was not possible.
If you could talk to Namu, what would you tell him?
I'd come back. I'm still ready for you.
Ted Griffin talked with 88.5's Bellamy Palethorpe. Griffin went on to catch dozens more orcas, including an almost entire pod during the notorious Penn Cove capture in 1970. He and his partner provided orcas to aquariums all over the world. Some of their operations resulted in orca deaths, and they became lightning rods for controversy and animal rights activists who want all orcas released from captivity. Griffin says he has no regrets about what he did. He eventually got out of the business because he was never able to find the same connection with the whale like the one he had with Namu. It's Sound Effect here on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. Our theme today is The Pursuit. You might remember David Liston from our eavesdropping show. He's a private investigator based in the Tacoma area. And one of the things that he does is find people who don't want to be found. Sound Effect's Gabriel Spitzer tells us, in this case, it was a little different.
Let me show you the guy.
Okay.
This is the guy that I was trying to find, the one who was going to become the multimillionaire.
The trick is, the person who stood to inherit those millions was a homeless man believed to be living on the streets in Seattle. Liston set out to find him with that picture.
Another agency in Salt Lake City had the case. They didn't want to send someone out to Seattle, and they had heard that my subject was maybe here. And the point of the story was to settle an estate in which a substantial amount of money was at stake.
So some elderly, wealthy person had died, and this was an heir that you were looking for?
Yes, one is one of them. There were only a couple. I didn't ever get an exact figure, but it was multiple millions of dollars.
Wow. So the person you were looking for stands to inherit millions of dollars.
Enough to take care of anybody for the rest of their lives and any family they might have had.
You know. This is one of those rare things where the person you'd expect them to be happy when you find them, right?
I thought, when I got this case, I was thinking, you know something, there's going to be a happy ending here. We have a person who we believe is homeless, and when we find him, we're going to give him this news that he doesn't have to worry about anything ever again financially. And so I set out looking for this fellow with a handful of posters that we'd made up from pictures like this one. And I canvassed they're sort of an informal homeless network. They know who each other are. And this one guy down in the Pioneer Square area looked at this poster, and I told him the story that you just heard. And he said, you know something, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put this on my fax distribution sheet, and I'm going to fax this to everybody I know. And we did all that and finally ran out of ideas. I'd gone to every place I could think of.
Yeah, it must be very challenging to find. I mean, you're looking for somebody without a fixed address, without a lot of records or a paper trail.
It's probably one of the hardest ones there is. Maybe on a par with people who are trying to be invisible. some months later, after really basically we'd just put it on hold, I got a phone call from a local hospital, and they said, we've got somebody here by this guy's name who says he knows who you are, and he said he knew that you're looking for him, and he's here. Could you come down? And I'm, now? Can I come now?
What was it like to get that phone call?
I couldn't believe it, really. It's because I'd kind of given up. I hadn't really cashed it in, but I was thinking, you know, we gave it a good shot, and just vapor, just time's ticking. So down to the hospital I went, finally found the room, and in the bed is somebody that I did not recognize. He was so different, almost science fiction different. It was almost like he had been cloned into some other creature.
Because he looked haggard? I mean, he looked like he'd been on the street?
He had gained a huge amount of weight. Everything was just basically wrong. But nobody faking this could have known the things that he knew because we hadn't made it public. So I got my cell phone out and called the attorneys for the estate and handed him the cell phone. That part of the conversation is all we hear is the kind of short answers. He's kind of mumbling basically into the phone.
He's certainly not doing a celebratory dance.
It was kind of more like having to talk to an internet service provider about an outage. It was kind of somber. And at the end of it, he just handed the phone back, and I asked them if they needed anything else, and they said no. And when I got back to my office, I called the Salt Lake agency and told them what had happened. And they got back to me a day or two later and said, he doesn't want it.
He doesn't want his millions?
Nope. The estate had wanted to put a trustee between him and the money. And the trustee was going to make sure that everything that he needed was going to be taken care of. But he wasn't going to just get this pile of money. So he refused it. I imagine they paid the hospital bill. But as far as I know, he went back out on the street.
What did you make of that? This guy who was living on the street, who is destitute, and you come and connect him with what could be millions of dollars to take care of his every need, and he says no.
I'm thinking it's one of two things. Either he had a rift with the family, and this would have been a matter of accepting something from sort of the enemy, or he wasn't going to have anybody tell him what to do. There was something about his life of having nothing that gave him a certain kind of freedom. Now, I don't know this. This is just my guess, that it wasn't going to be worth it.
Does that make you think, man, that guy is stupid, or that's tragic, or, wow, I kind of respect that guy sticking to his guns?
I'm thinking that our version of happiness may be not the same as somebody else's. And for him, even though he was suffering physically greatly from lack of money, and lack of health insurance or health care and proper diet, it could be otherwise. This is pretty good. I think I said that there's not anybody that I know of that would refuse a deal like you're being offered.
And how did he answer that?
Sure, just shook his head. Nope. You know, and that's the thing about some of these cases. In fact, most of them, we don't know how they turn out. And I don't know how his has turned out. I wish I did.
Well, the agency is David Liston Investigative Services, based in University Place, and David Liston is the agency principal there. Thank you so much, Dave.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Wing. It's Sound Effect here on 88.5 KNKX, and our show this week is all about stories of pursuit. And for people who feel like they were born in the wrong body, it can be a long and difficult journey to get their outside to match how they feel inside. One piece of this is the person's voice. transgender people in Seattle have long turned to one woman for help. Sandy Hirsch is a speech pathologist who specializes in working with trans people, and she gets results. When clients come into her office, she has them read this sentence.
When the sunlight strikes raindrops in the air, they act like a prism and form a rainbow.
Then, after working together for a while, they record the same sentence again to gauge the progress. Producer Warren Langford caught up with Hirsch and a couple of her clients, each in pursuit of her own voice.
When Schiff Adelson began transitioning, this was the moment she knew she needed help.
I was hanging out with a friend of mine, and as I was walking her out the door, and I said goodbye. And, you know, I'd been perfectly happy and in a good spirits the entire night until that moment I caught the sound of my own voice, and I just broke and burst into tears. There was this disconnect between what I heard coming out of my mouth and what I expected from who I understood myself to be.
When you're thinking about people transitioning genders, generally what comes to mind is the body challenges, how you dress, what your hair looks like, the makeup, and what bathroom you use. But the voice, it's a whole other thing. Even if you look in the mirror and recognize that person as yourself, can you imagine listening to yourself speak and hearing somebody else? That's what Schiff was dealing with. She does customer support for a tech company, and so all day her voice is all she has to present herself. Her voice is the only thing customers will know of her. Even though Schiff uses the she and her pronouns, she came up against an even more unexpected complication. She doesn't consider herself to be male or female. She doesn't fall into a category. For Schiff, her gender is not a stationary thing.
Even after I said, yes, I am absolutely trans, I am starting to transition, there was still a lot of internal resistance because I didn't have that clear, yes, I am clearly feminine, female, let's go 100% all the way.
So like many in Seattle who are transitioning genders, Schiff turned to speech pathologist Sandy Hirsch. Sandy's practice is called Give Voice, and she's one of a handful in the field who specialize in working with the transgender community. As a kid, Sandy's family moved a lot. Belgium, Germany, Switzerland, England, ultimately landing here in the States. She says it was that lack of rootedness that made her relate to the struggles of transitioning genders.
Because I do understand what it feels like to be not quite comfortable in your skin. Adaptable everywhere, but never quite in the center.
Sandy is an actress and a singer, but found it hard to make ends meet. So she took what she learned about using her own voice and began teaching others. She started seeing trans clients in the late 90s, discovered she had a knack for it, word got around, and she found herself with a months-long wait list. In the last few years, that clientele and the vocal issues they want to address have been changing. More and more, her clients are like Schiff, seeking to speak in a way that falls somewhere in between what we think of as masculine or feminine, or maybe out of that spectrum entirely.
There have been so many societal changes and so many changes in the way we really define gender, period. I have had more and more people coming to me, younger and younger and younger, wanting to learn, really, I want to learn how to use my instrument, and I want to learn everything I possibly can about my instrument so I can make some informed choices about how to communicate based on where I am at any given time.
Sandy doesn't just focus on voice, but also how her clients use language and even body language. Schiff showed me how Sandy taught her to use a tuning app to help her find the tone she's comfortable with. She holds the phone in front of her mouth and watches as a needle registers the note she's hitting.
Meet me, Peter. Meet me, Peter. Meet me. Meet me, Peter. Meet me. Meet me, Peter. Meet me.
I went to Sandy's clinic to sit in on a different session with her client, Lena Chappelle. Lena has a blonde bob and glasses, and she sits next to Sandy at a desk with a large microphone perched between them.
So I think we should just see where your voice is today.
Sure, yeah.
And then before we do that, I want to know, how has it been working for you? And, you know,
this session turns out to be more of a checkup.
Would you describe your voice, the way you're hearing it, as a lower feminine voice? How would you describe it?
I'd say, yeah, a lower feminine voice. And it's one that I've become more comfortable with as I've been getting sort of you know, both getting better at achieving the voice goals that I want to have, but also kind of becoming more comfortable with the natural range that I have developed.
Sandy listens to how Lena sounds. They record her talking naturally about her last vacation, and then they listen to the tape of her previous session, and this is how it sounds.
In February, I'm actually going to be traveling to Montreal. I'm going to be visiting my girlfriend who lives over there, and
you might notice there's not much difference, and that's a good thing. Lena's at a place where she can sustain it without having to think about it. That's the victory. She can present herself with ease and confidence. And maybe that's the place we're all trying to get, to be ourselves without it being such a big deal. And remember Schiff, who works in customer support? She's getting to that point too. She showed me how she answers the phone at work now.
Thank you for contacting Intermedia Support. My name is Schiff. May I have your name, please? I guess you could consider it a little more gender creative. I am trying to express myself authentically in a way that feels comfortable and natural to me, and that doesn't have to fall into a category like male or female, and that can be okay.
And that's the power of what Sandy does for people. It's much more than training people to speak like a man or a woman. With Sandy, it's about learning to speak like you.
And all of the work that I've done as a speech pathologist, really, if I have to boil it down, has to do with training people to be able to communicate and tell their own story in the most honest way that they can.
That story from producer Warren Langford. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today our theme is The Pursuit. This next story is tough to listen to. It comes from a guy named Timothy Minyard, who spent years in law enforcement investigating international human trafficking. His stories deal with some very, very difficult subject matter, the exploitation of children. And you don't want your kids hearing this. And it'll be hard for a lot of adults to hear as well. But it's an important story. It conveys the horrors of these crimes and the impact on the people who work to prevent them from happening. This story is about 12 minutes long, so if you want to skip it, we understand, and we'll meet up again next week. Tim Minyard has to live with the difficult memories from this line of work. They've contributed to his post-traumatic stress disorder. So to talk about it, 88.5's Gabriel Spitzer found a peaceful spot in his backyard in a rural part of Pierce County.
When I need to talk, this is where I come. Got a good view of the mountain, and usually this grass is rustling a bit like it is now. And it kind of sucks the pain out of it. And I tend to seek out shade just because I'm terminally Scottish.
Minyard is a big man, over 6 feet tall, about 300 pounds, with a bald head and a great big red beard. But his manner is gentle, and he's honest about the scars that he carries from being exposed so long to humanity's dark side.
I was an executive protection provider in the International District in Seattle.
Security guy.
Yeah. The man that I worked for did not willfully participate in human trafficking, but he was a very large player in the import-export field. Vietnam, Thailand, Hong Kong, places like that. But a lot of his money and a lot of his contacts, whenever I'd travel out of the country with him, I would interact with these people. I knew that they were bad people at the time, but...
How could you tell?
Well, when you're sitting in a room watching them play their gambling games and there's concerning looking gentlemen standing around with fully automatic weapons and there's checkpoints, it's kind of obvious there's some illegitimate going on. And I had witnessed obvious transgressions. I mean, some of the women that were around these guys were clearly in their early teens. I knew, but I never felt compelled to do anything. I still harbor a little guilt from that, but it was what it was. The truth is, it got me in deep enough that when I was approached by State Department and Department of Justice inquiring about my interest in helping, it went from there and turned into a full-time gig, basically.
So would you be posing as a broker or a customer? How would you be? How would you wind up on site in these places?
I had already developed a reputation amongst all of these people, and it gave me insight and opportunities to do surveillance work, develop plans, locate compounds where the distribution points and actual operations where they house the girls and sometimes boys. It was a very exciting time. Initially, I thought I was saving the world. And
tell me more about that. How did you kind of feel about the work you were doing? Where did you see your mission?
Well, I was never sexually abused as a child, but I was abused emotionally and physically terribly as a child. And I look back on it now and I realize that I felt like I was lashing out at that and doing anything I could possibly do to protect other kids. And my intent was, I'm going to end this. I'm going to stop this. I'm going to stop them or kill them, whatever. I don't care. It eventually came to the realization that I couldn't stop it, but I could make it as difficult on them as I could. The gist is we had one of our guys, he would go into these clubs and he had the energy and the looks to get away with all kinds of crazy, right? My other two primary teammates, my handler and my best friend on the planet, we would do a lot of the peripheral surveillance and security while he did his thing. And we would gain access to these brothels. It became very delicate at those points because when our fourth team member would go into these rooms or into these places with these young girls, he had to very carefully determine whether or not he could just say, no, you know what, never mind, I'm married or something, I can't do this. Or he could actually just give them a little extra money and say, listen, I just want to sit. He, not unlike all of us, at one point or another have had to sit and listen to little girls be raped. And it's misery. And you never get it out of your mind. But it would give us direct access to, once we knew where the brothels were, we could figure out who the operators were. When we figured out who the operators were, we could track them back to distribution points and assets. I eventually learned it didn't matter. You end one operation and somebody just picks it up from there. And that's how I came to terms with the fact that it was time to get the whole save the world thing out of my mind and just concentrate on making it really difficult. I remember that being a really bitter pill. Really bitter.
Would you be comfortable talking about like a particular operation? I don't know if there was a particular bad guy that you worked really hard to track down and to put out of business, and that you could kind of walk us through that story.
Yeah, this particular story started out as a custodial issue. The father absconded with the children out of the Everett area. And by the time I got the case, it had gone from a custodial kidnap to a pornography issue. And what this guy was doing was he was renting out his 6 and 8 year old son and daughter, renting them out at parties. But he was a sicko. And he was one of those guys that was hard to find, but we found him in Arizona. And my partner and I, we located the residence he was in and did a quick surveillance and determined his presence. The kids were there. Everything was quiet, nothing crazy going on. Lights went out. We waited a couple hours and then we decided we'd do a stealth entry.
I'm going to just pipe up here and again say this story is pretty upsetting and is not appropriate for kids. Mignard says he and his partner entered the house and they found the guy asleep with the daughter. There was a gun on the side table. Mignard woke the guy up, pointing his own gun in his face, and with thoughts of pulling the trigger, just said, go ahead.
There was a pause, and then I felt this bear paw on my right shoulder, and it was my partner. And he said, don't do this. She's been through enough. If you kill somebody in front of her, it's how is that going to help?
So you were waiting for him to go for his weapon, and that would give you a pretext to do him in?
Yeah, I was just going to shoot him right in the face. That's all he deserved. I still feel he deserved it, but that little girl there and my partner, you know, brought me back to at least a common sense circumstance. I got her and her little brother, and I waited for the equivalent down there, Child Protective Services, to come get them. They were going to facilitate an almost immediate transportation. While we're sitting at this Denny's-like place, the little girl was the older, and she clearly was the protector of the boy. She said, well, why can't you take us back? You won't hurt us. And I said, well, honey, that's really not how it works. And I have other kids I gotta go help. And then, you know, these people will take good care of you. You'll be safe. And they'll get you home to your mom, and you can get back to somewhere safe. And she says, well, she said, I'll give you any sex you want. And I was physically ill with the sincerity and the commitment in that statement to me. And I told her, honey, that's not how things are. I said, that's not okay. You're a beautiful being. This isn't how you need to be treated. I didn't know what to say. But I saw to the end of that. They got home to their mom. That's one of my particular traumas, because I have a daughter and my stepdaughter. That's really when it all started to fall in 1998, when my daughter was born. And I really started taking these scoundrels very personally. I didn't want them in the same world that my daughter was in. I really eventually got so bad that I was a liability to everybody. My team was covering for my missteps, and I was risking their lives and their careers. And that's finally in 2007. It just was time to go. And I knew it was time to go. I couldn't handle the work anymore.
So what are the ways that you found to cope with this and to be okay with your memories?
Well, I've really had to learn to accept compliments. It's still hard when someone says thank you for everything you've done. And I try to hold on to that and realize that, you know, I did good work. Therapy is a regular need. My wife is the most stubborn, obnoxious turd on the planet, but I love her to pieces. And the fact that she tolerates me is pretty incredible. And then moving back to my roots, you know, when I grew up, despite my childhood, I grew up on a small, functional farm. A whole lot more property than this, but there's always something to fix. There's always something to mow. There's always animals to tend. I get to do a little patrol every night with the dogs and make sure that everybody's roosted up for the night and there's no stragglers. We've got coyotes and whatnot around.
Could you show me around a little bit, maybe, and introduce me to some of these critters?
This is where they sleep at night.
Mostly chickens in here?
Yeah, we have English Orpingtons. We have Buff Orpingtons.
So can I ask you just one more thing?
Yeah.
What do you get out of taking care of these animals?
Frankly, I feel useful having all these babies around to care for and look after. Kind of keeps my super cop gene in check. It's probably more ego boost than anything, but it helps me feel needed. That's pretty much what it boils down to.
That story from Sound Effects' Gabriel Spitzer. Timothy Mignard is out of the law enforcement business. He lives in rural Pierce County. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson, with contributions this week from Warren Langford, Bellamy Palethorpe, and Gabriel Spitzer. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can find our podcast on iTunes, and you can also find Sound Effect on the NPR One app. And if you have any feedback, or maybe there's a story you'd like to share, you can send us an email to soundeffect@knkx.org. We'll be back next week when our theme is Not a Kid Anymore.
My feet was barely even touching the floor. You know, I looked like what I was, a child, a 13-year-old child. And I was tried as an adult. I was convicted.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.